I also feel that I'm far within the mark when I say that the greatest event that has happened in your lifetime or mine has been the rebirth of the State of Israel. November 29, 1947 is the red letter day for the United Nations, probably the accomplishment of the so-called United Nations in our time. No nation in the world has as much right to exist as does the State of Israel, because no nation in the world has as many birth certificates as does the State of Israel. There may not always be a United States. As much as I love Switzerland, I talk to my Swiss friends all over the world, and I say, for pity's sake, if I ever lived in Switzerland, I'd never want to leave the place. But there may not always be a United States. There may not always be a Switzerland. There may not always be an Argentine, but there's always going to be an Israel. It's impossible to have a world without an Israel. I was just looking in the book of Jeremiah here. God tells you how to get rid of the Jew. People want to know how to get rid of the Jew. And they talk, that's true. God tells you how to get rid of them. And in the 31st chapter, thus saith the Lord, verse 35, who giveth the sun for a light by day, and the ordinances of the moon and of the stars for a light by night, who divideth the sea when its waves roar. The Lord of hosts is his name. Now listen. If those ordinances depart from before me, saith the Lord, that is, if you can have a day without a sun. I always ask the children, why in the world the sun shines in the daytime when you don't need it, and it doesn't shine at night when you do need it? You know, that's the problem. But if you can get rid of sun by day and darkness at night, if you can have waves without a trough in between, God said, if those ordinances depart from before me, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me forever. Pretty strong language. Thus saith the Lord, if heaven above can be measured, and the foundations of the earth searched out beneath, I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith the Lord. So that's a pretty strong statement. And the same thing in the 33rd chapter. I say no nation in the world has as much right to exist as does the State of Israel, because no nation has as many birth certificates. Israel has at least four. The first birth certificate that was ever handed to Israel was handed to a very, very strange man 450 years before there was ever a nation. You never hear of a birth certificate handed to anybody before they're born. But this is 450 years before there was ever a nation. Handed to this man we heard of in both messages this morning, this strange man by the name of Abram, later on spoken of as Abraham. I've often felt sorry for that man with that name, Abraham. You see, if I had a name like Gustafson, I certainly wouldn't feel sorry for a man with Abraham. Well, I'll tell you why. He lived down in Hebron. And suppose he decided to go up to that little outpost in the Judean hills, as it was in those days, called Salem, to see his old friend Melchizedek. And while he's there in town, he's a stranger, never seen him before. He said, you're new in town, aren't you? I said, yeah, just came in yesterday. Household goods come in Friday, Mayflower. Is that right? And what is your name, sir? And he gives him his name. And what is your name? Father of many. That's what Abraham means. Is that so? How many children do you have? None. I mean, can you imagine the embarrassment of walking around nearly 100 years with the name Father of Many and having no kids? But God said to Abram, unto thy seed I'm going to give this land. Not only will I give this land, as he'd called him out of Ur of the Chaldees, he said, I am going to make of thee a great nation. I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. I wonder if you've read this verse lately. It's in Exodus chapter 32 and verse 13. Every now and then someone comes and says, you know, I'd like to read the Bible, but I'll be honest with you, I can't make heads and tails out of the Bible. Well, if you can understand English at all, you can understand this one. Moses is speaking, he's talking to God. And many times you have in the Bible where different servants of God remind God of things. It's a very interesting word to go through the Bible and just look up the word remember. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants, to whom thou didst swear by thine own self. Now, let me stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance. To our knowledge, God has only sworn by himself in an oath three times. Makes a good message, the times God swore. When God ever swears by himself in an oath, it is absolutely irrevocable. It cannot be changed. He swears by himself because he can't swear by a greater. It's not contingent on the faithfulness of an individual or a group or a nation or anything, whatever they do or don't do. When God swears by himself in an oath, it is absolutely unchangeable. And God, Moses says to God, remember Abraham, Isaac, Israel, thy servants, to whom thou didst swear by thine own self and saidst unto them, I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven. Now listen. And all this land that I have spoken of will I give unto your seed, and they shall inherit it forever. And again, I know I'm far within the mark when I say that the United Nations, no confederation of nations, will ever build a diplomatic fence high enough to keep Israel from having the land that God gave to Abraham's seed and gave it to him forever. Not the little 8,000 square miles that they had before the Six-Day War. Not even the territory that they have now. Someone said Israel is a very peace-loving country. They want a piece of Lebanon, a piece of Syria, and a piece of Jordan, a piece of Saudi Arabia. But this all belongs to them. And they're all talking now what they're going to give up. Well, I can tell you one thing. They're not going to give up anything. In fact, they're going to take a little bit more. They were in Lebanon last week. And the border, if you look in the Bible, they've got to go between Tyre and Sidon, up at Zarephath, where Elijah went, if you recall. That'll be the border, and they're heading toward that right now. And they've told Lebanon, if you can't take care of these guerrillas, we'll move in and help you take care of them. And that's their attitude. But that was the first birth certificate that was ever handed to them. Handed to them to a man by the name of Abraham. Now, the second birth certificate that was handed to him was handed to that amazing man that we all love, David. King David. In the 7th chapter of 2 Samuel, God speaks to David, and he's not speaking primarily about Solomon. He's speaking about one who is greater than Solomon. And he says to him, if I can find it, when thy days be fulfilled, David, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers. That must have been an awful situation in the Old Testament. They're always sleeping with their fathers. But thou shalt sleep with thy fathers. They didn't have king-sized beds, I don't think. Thou shalt sleep with thy fathers. I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thine own body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall establish my house for a name, and house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Look at verse 16. Thine house, David, thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee, and thy throne shall be established forever. And I believe, Jack, that you read this morning from Jeremiah chapter 23. I was in Athens on one occasion. I went in the Israeli consul and embassy, whatever they have there. And I was talking, and they said, well, we wouldn't know the name of Messiah if he came. I said, oh, yes, you will. You'll know him when he comes. Behold, the day is set the Lord, come set the Lord, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and a king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth. In his days, Judah shall be saved. Not saved yet. Israel shall dwell safely. Everybody's wondering, where are the 10 lost tribes of Israel? I know where they are. This is the 1st of March. They're all in Miami Beach. The 10 lost tribes are there. In fact, there are so many of them there that they call the bridge between Miami and Miami Beach the Jewish Passover. In his days, Judah shall be saved, and Israel shall dwell safely, and this is his name whereby he shall be called Jehovah Tzidkenu. The Lord our righteousness. I know we're on the right track, because Jesus Christ is made unto us righteousness. Have you ever noticed that the second proper noun in the New Testament is the name David? The next to the last proper noun of the New Testament, apart from names of deity, is the name David. So the New Testament begins with David and ends with David. All of the hope of the world. The only solution to the problems of this world is going to be the reestablishment of the throne of David. The 89th Psalm is an enlargement on this 2 Samuel chapter 7. I have a book in my library, and Ralph, maybe your father has it. I know your granddad did. And I have a copy, but don't ask to borrow mine. I would let my grandmother borrow it. I'd let her read it in my study, but no, dang it, out of my study. It's called God's Oath. God's Oath by Ford Ottman, O-T-T-M-A-N. If you can find that book, buy it, steal it, or anything you can do to get that book. I think that's the answer to just about every ism, asm, and spasm abroad in the land of today. And the whole thing is an exposition on Psalm 89. When God says to David, I am going to build up your throne from generation to generation to generation, and that's why I feel it's so tremendously important as a believer to go to Israel today. Because remember, as a Christian believer, you'll see far, far more in that land than any Orthodox Jew can see. Because he's blind. He's fallen, he's desolate, he's blinded. But if you go and allow the Lord Jesus to look through your eyes, you'll sense that the presence of God stands in those shadows. The first birth certificate was handed to Abraham. The second one to David. The third birth certificate that was handed to Israel was handed by the League of Nations in June 1922. And most of you younger people don't even know that the League of Nations ever existed, but they did. And it happened right here in Switzerland. And the fourth birth certificate that was handed to Israel, November 29th, 1947, at Lake Success, New York. To me, I cannot understand how anyone could ever be consistent living in this world, especially a Christian, if they're anti-Semitic. And I'm using the word Semitism in connection with the Jews. When you stop to think that here are people, only 13 million of them in the world. There were 18 million at the beginning of World War II. Hitler killed 6 million. There are now 13 million. They live in 117 different countries. You can go anywhere in the world and find two things, a Jew and a Coca-Cola bottle. They're there. In fact, you know, the United States has this Operation Deep Freeze going out of Christchurch, New Zealand, down to the South Pole. And did you know that when our scientists got to the South Pole, the first time they found Jews there already? The iceberg family. I mean, they're all there. And Ice Cream Cohen. You can find him most anywhere. But you can find the Jews just like the Lord Jesus said. Sifted and scattered among 117 countries of the world. They are only 0.4% of the world's population. They have captured more than 12% of all the honors when it comes to science and health and medicine and music. As Moshe Dayan said the other day, we have the reputation of being good fighters. And, of course, as U.S. News and World Report said, that man for man, they're the best army in the world. He said, I hope that it won't be long before we will have a much better reputation of being great musicians and great artists. I say it's quite impossible to be in this world and be consistently anti-Semitic. If you ever get such a thing as a headache, I hope that you will never have the unmitigated gall to ever take an aspirin tablet or anything with aspirin in it if you're consistently anti-Semitic. Because the discoverer of aspirin happened to be a Jew by the name of Bayer. We don't worry too much anymore about the polio season. We used to think, well, summer's coming on. Maybe this summer, my little girl, my little boy will wind up in an iron lung. When's the last time you heard of anybody winding up in an iron lung? Because of the work of two Jews, Jonas Salk and Sabin. Both of these, of course, well, one of them in the hospital down in Cleveland, Ohio, just had open heart surgery last week. But you say, yeah, I'll bet they really cleaned up on it. Not a penny. Someone suggested that everyone with a child send a dollar for each child to that man. And I would have been happy to have done it. No one started the thing, so I kept my dollar. But that happened to be the work of two Jews, Salk and Sabin. If you ever get heart trouble, I hope that you'll never take digitalis, because that happened to be the discovery of another Jew by the name of Trabel. And if you go to the dentist, perish that thought. You know, you walk in the door, and he said, well, we've got to do a little drilling today. Do you want to take it barefooted? Do you want a little injection? I said, double shot. I hope that you'll take it raw, because the one that discovered that happened to be another Jew by the name of Solomon Stricker. If you get tuberculosis, you should never take streptomycin, because Waksman happened to be a Jew. And in the United States, you couldn't get married if you're consistently anti-Semitic, because Wasserman happened to be a Jew. And you have to take a Wasserman test. Well, by the looks of this crowd, I haven't been here very long. and I'm glad that you brought your own psychiatrist with you. I just had one with me. But I think by looking over this crowd, you're going to have a pretty thriving business before too long. But if you're consistently anti-Semitic, I hope that you'll never avail yourself of the services of the psychiatrist, because the father of all psychoanalysis happened to be a Jew by the name of Freud. In fact, you can hang all history on six Jewish names: Moses, Jesus Christ, Saul of Tarsus, Sigmund Freud, Einstein, and Karl Marx. All of history you can hang on six Jewish names. If you are consistently anti-Semitic, you couldn't go to university and study philosophy because Spinoza happened to be a Jew. You should never give to the Salvation Army. You say, now what in the world does the Salvation Army have to do with the Jews? Well, General William Booth was the father of the Salvation Army. His mother was a Jewess. And according to the law of return, that is, you know what the law of return is? If there's a Jew living in any remote place in the world and doesn't have two dimes to rub together, which would be highly unlikely. But if he didn't have two dimes to rub together and he wanted to go to Israel, if his mother was a Jewish, it comes through the mother. You're not always exactly sure who your father is, but you're reasonably sure who your mother is. So if your mother is a Jewess, you can contact any Jewish agency. They'll see that you get to Israel, and the day you put your foot on the soil, you become a citizen. You don't have to be naturalized. My father came from Sweden. I don't know how many years it took him to get naturalized. But you don't, if you're a Jew, you don't have to get naturalized because it's a child who's come home. Some of you, I know, your children now are growing up, and you say, oh, what a day. If they'll only get grown, then we can start saving some money. I have news for you. Don't count on it. It's going to get worse. You know, when they leave, then they come back home, they'll rob you blind. Well, the Lord doesn't know it, but my daughter attends his church. She comes home, and boy, she says, Mother, I've always liked that picture. Boy, take it. Take it. Another one's taken. Handed to us. We had sterling silver for 12. Another one got that. We have Japanese stainless steel. That's all we have left. And I'm not joking. You think that when they go, you think your problems are over. They're just beginning. They'll come in. They'll eat you out of house and home. Now, I don't say to my daughters when they come back home, oh, wait a minute now. You left this house. You've got to get naturalized before you. Of course not. They're my children. So they don't say they have to be naturalized to come back home. Any Jew, anyway, this is home to them. And in 5 months, they can vote. 13,000 came from Russia last year, and they're expecting 50,000 out of Russia this year. Maybe this is what we are seeing, at least the foreshadowing of the real fulfillment. Let me put this in by way of parenthesis. This may conflict with your eschatology, whatever that might be. But this is not the age of prophecy we're living in now. This is the age of the mystery. This is the age when God is visiting the Gentiles to call out a people for his name. After this, I'll return. But the coming events cast their shadows before. And maybe this is the foreshadowing of when God is going to say to the north, give up. And you see, there are more Jews in New York City than there are in Israel. Most Jews live in the United States. Second, Russia. Third, Israel. Fourth, France. And fifth, the Argentine, I think. That's the way they go. But we're seeing now God calling them from the nations. So if General William Booth were alive today, General William Booth could go back. So General William Booth was a Jew. You should never give the Salvation Army if you're anti-Semitic. You couldn't be a communist because Karl Marx was a Jew. You couldn't be a Christian because Jesus Christ was a Jew. And this may jar your grandmother's preserves. But if Jesus Christ were alive on earth today, he wouldn't be in First Baptist Church with Judas D.D. Pastor. Whatever the hell, you know. He wouldn't be in the First Baptist Church on Sunday morning. He'd be in the synagogue on Friday night. Because he would never preach to a Gentile. He wouldn't preach to the Gentiles. He said, I'm only sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and he was the fulfillment of the covenants to Israel. And remember, no Gentile ever had any covenant. The only covenant you can ever lay hold upon is the new covenant that was made between the Father and the Son and sealed with his blood. These other covenants were made to the Jews, whether you like it or whether you don't like it. You are an outsider, without hope, without God, without Christ, far off, aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers from the covenants of promise. In fact, the Lord Jesus himself called Gentiles dogs. I've loved my Bible since I was 18 years old. But there's one thing I've got against the Bible. A serious thing against the Bible. The Bible doesn't have a decent word to say about a dog. And I can hardly wait to get home. I'll see my wife and kids, I suppose, a lot, but that dog, I've got it home. He weighs 5 pounds, Samson. I'm anxious to see him. But the Lord Jesus, he said, I can't take my children's bread and give it to you a dog. And that Gentile woman never got anything until she took her rightful place as a little dog. She said, at least crumbs fall to the little dogs around the table. And then instead of getting crumbs, you got the whole loaf. You remember that. Mark Twain visits the Holy Land. Mark Twain is not known for being a Christian believer. But this is what he said. The Jew could be vain of himself and not be ashamed of it. Yes, he could be excused for it. The Babylonian, the Persian, the Egyptian filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Others have sprung up and held the torch high for a time, but it burned out and it vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert, aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. Then he asked a question that he couldn't answer, but God did. What is the secret of his immortality? God said, I am the Lord. Therefore, ye sons of Jacob are not consumed. You told me to take as long as I want. I may do it. I may be the only one standing here talking but listening, but I'll be here. I'd like to talk to you for a little while tonight because no one's here but us and no place to go. About the fourfold miracle of modern Israel. And you remember when we were in school, they said any decent sermon ought to have three parts to it. Tell the people what you're going to tell them. First part, you've noticed your preacher does it. Excuse me, pastors, for betraying the secrets of the ministry. This is what they tell you. Tell the congregation what you're going to tell them. Secondly, tell them. Thirdly, tell them what you told them. And you'll notice just about every sermon works out that way. The fourfold miracle of Israel is this. There is the language miracle. There is the sociological miracle. There is the agricultural industrial miracle. And there's the military miracle of modern Israel. First of all, the language miracle. Israel is the only country in the history of the world, the only country in the history of the world, where children teach their parents their mother tongue. I think I heard a psychiatrist friend talking to somebody in here in the little snack shop here today, something about development of a child and what they learn, this and that. And I think that you would agree with that. At least psychologists and others do say that children do not learn from children. That is, they learn from adults. Whatever language you speak, I don't know what you talk around here. But I know you learned it from adults. You didn't learn it from children. But Israel is the only country in the history of the world where parents learn their native tongue from their children. You take a Jew that comes from the Argentine, or from South Africa, or from Canada, or from Indonesia, or from India, or from China. I have a friend. He's from Vienna. German is his first language. He speaks better English than I do. He speaks Spanish. He speaks Italian. I attended his son's bar mitzvah at the synagogue in Tel Aviv last year. And he's a Kohen. If you know what a Kohen is, a Kohathite in the Bible. So it's a very sacred name, very sacred place. And so he should have known Hebrew. But when he went in, he had some prayers to say for his son's bar mitzvah. But his kids had to write them out for him in phonetically, in English or something. And old Herman stood there and read those prayers. And you ought to hear his children laugh at Daddy. And they're teaching Daddy Hebrew. An ancient tongue has never been revived. They tried to revive Latin. And I'm eternally grateful they never made any progress with that. I had 3 report cards full of Latin. And I got 3 straight F's. Fortunate for me, my father came from Sweden. And I brought the report card home, and I said, you see this right here, Latin? F, F, F. That means fine, fine, fine. So Oh, the old man pat me on the head and said, my, you're doing so well at that, you could pick that up on your own. Why don't you drop that and take up cane seating or something like that? So I thanked him, and it had already dropped me, and I quit. They tried to revive ancient Gaelic in Ireland, even changed the street signs, but they never got out that off the ground. But when you stop to think, the miracle of language that today a young man or a young woman will write a PhD thesis in nuclear physics at that Technion in Haifa, which is the MIT of Israel, or will write a PhD thesis in some other subject at that great Hebrew University in Jerusalem, one of the greatest institutions of learning in the world, or at the Weizmann Institute, where they make heavy water and sell it to the United States, and will write that in Hebrew. Now, if you know the Old Testament, you know that Hebrew is a very limited vocabulary in the Old Testament. How in the world are you ever going to take a language that's been dead now for all of these years and jettison it into the 20th century, in the atomic age, and still keep with biblical Hebrew, because there wasn't a person on earth 100 years ago that spoke Hebrew as his first language. It was kept for the sacred correspondence of rabbis and things like that, but the people never did. In fact, they didn't want it. They said, as we come back to this land, Yiddish is plenty good enough for us. But Yiddish is a bastard language. It's not Hebrew, it's not Jew, it was just no good. They said, why not English? You can go anywhere in the world with English. Why not German, when so many came from from Western Europe? But in 1872, and remember, when you hear all the propaganda that this land over there has for time immemorial been under the Arabs, if you know history, you know this just is not true. For 400 years, from 1517 to 1917, that whole part of the world was the Ottoman Empire, was Turkish. In 1872, the Turks said, no more Jews can come in here. Whenever you tell the people they're not going to do anything, that's the very thing they make up their mind they're going to do. So a fellow came in, and up in the area around, the northern part of Israel, where today they grow the grapes that make the best wine in Israel, a little fellow was born. And his daddy named him Ben Yehuda, son of Judah. He wouldn't employ anyone to take care of that child except someone who would speak Hebrew words in his ears. The first words that he was to hear would be Hebrew. Ben Yehuda caught this vision from his daddy to revive ancient Hebrew, always going to the Bible for coining new words. For instance, the word lightning comes from that Hebrew judge Barak, Deborah and Barak. It means lightning. They always went to the Bible to coin the new words. When you get off the airplane, for instance, in Lud Airport, which is Lydda in the New Testament, and you go into Jerusalem on a bus, you go through two biblical cities by the name of Eshtiol and Zora, right past a little brook called Sorek, where a guy walked hand in hand with a gal by the name of Delilah. You get a little bit further, and it's not a Howard Johnson's, but it's sort of a little roadside place. You get some refreshments. It's called Samson's Inn. I stopped there once, but he was out and haven't been back. But we go to the left to go to Jerusalem, but if you were to go to the right, you'd go to Beit Shemesh. And if you remember Beit Shemesh, where the men looked into the Holy Ark that have been sent from the Philistines, and God smote them. Today, they have a cement factory at Beit Shemesh. And if you're going to buy cement, you're going to buy a sack of cement from there, and it's called Shimshon, Samson cement. You buy a set of tires for your car, they're going to be Samson tires. Everything is by the Bible. Everything biblical names. Everything comes from the Scriptures. And even their modern-day Hebrew, all of their roots come from the Scripture. In fact, the prophet Amos could come back today and could thunder forth the judgments of the law like he did hundreds of years ago. In fact, he could check into Tel Aviv Hilton a whole lot easier than Shakespeare could ever check into BOAC in London. Can you imagine Shakespeare with that lingo of his? Now, my wife, she says she knows him and she understands him. I've tried, honestly, I've tried. When they have a Shakespeare thing on the television, I've sat for 15 minutes. At least. And I try, but I can't make heads or tails. I don't think anybody else can, honestly. Now, you're going to think I'm terrible. But to me, it's a shame they didn't bury his works with it. That's Shakespeare. Can you imagine Shakespeare going in a BOAC in London and standing there and saying, to fly or not to fly, that is the question. But the prophets could come back today. And you know another interesting thing about Hebrew? Hebrew is a language with which you cannot curse. Did you know that? There's no cursing in Hebrew. The worst they could ever call you would be a donkey, and that's we use that in a complimentary sense. I have Israeli Jewish friends who purposely have learned Arabic so they could curse. I mean, you can really curse in Arabic, and if you're really anxious to get at it, you learn Russian. Russian is tailor-made for cursing. But they tell me, and I went to the wall the other night. You may think I'm a pagan or something, but I love to go to the wall. I went to that Western Wall, the Wailing Wall. Of course, they have two Wailing Walls now. They have one in West Jerusalem where they pay the income tax. You ought to hear them when they wail at that one. But really, I love to go to the Western Wall, that retaining wall of the temple area at night, and look on those stones that the Lord Jesus passed many times. Those stones, some from Herod's day, some of the stones from Solomon's day. But they hear them there in their prayers. And they tell me that if you can understand, if you can't understand Hebrew, you've never heard anybody pray. If you can, if it wouldn't melt your heart, you'd have a stone in there instead of a heart of flesh. There's something about Hebrew. Maybe, I'm not saying that, maybe this is what God had in mind when he spoke to Zephaniah, that I'm going to return to you in the last days a pure language. Maybe Hebrew is the pure language. I don't know. So this is the language miracle. It has never happened before that an ancient people have been restored to their homeland and to their original language. Never has happened in history before. It's happening in our time. And when I get out that airport and I look up there and I hear the first word, shalom, and hear them speaking in Hebrew, I said, there, right there. And even though they may not believe in God, I still look in their eye and say, listen, you're the biggest proof to me that the Bible is true. The Jew is the greatest proof that the Bible is true. The second miracle is a sociological miracle. When Israel was reborn, 1947-1948, of course, they'd been under the British mandate after World War No. 2. France had Syria, Lebanon. Britain had what was then Palestine. Don't you ever dare call this Palestine anymore, or I'll pray that all your grandchildren have hangnails. Since there are no more Philistines, there is no more a Palestine. You understand? The Romans hung that on them in 135 A.D. because the Philistines were the great enemies of the Jews, and the Romans want to irk the Jews, and that's why they call it Palestine. But there's no Palestine today. It is the Bible, if you're going to use it, the Bible language, it is the land of Israel. Use Bible language while you're at it. Anyway, the British Mandate. And when the last British soldier had left the soil, Ben Gurion jumped to the gun, who I consider to be the greatest Jew on earth today, if I have to limit to the Jews. David Ben Gurion declared the state of Israel. Seven equipped Arab armies. Israel then only had less than 500,000 people. 500,000, all told. Lebanon to the north, of course, in the Six-Day War, you knew why the Lebanese Air Force didn't go into action against Israel, you know, or the Syria and Iraq and Jordan and Egypt. The Lebanese Air Force didn't go into action because their pilot was sick that day. But the equipped army in Lebanon, a well-equipped army to the north from Syria, an equipped army from Iraq, which has no common border with Israel. The best-trained army was to the east, Jordan, trained under Glab Pasha. From southeast came Saudi Arabia, from the south, Yemen, and then from the southwest, a well-equipped army, Egypt. They decided that Israel would die before it was ever born. Not a slightest vestige of a chance that they would ever exist. No newspaper reporter ever checked into a hotel for more than a month. General Montgomery said, they'll never make it. General Marshall said, the Jews have had it. I mean, they came within the environs of Tel Aviv. Israel had no planes. They had no equipment. If you come with me sometime, and I hope you will, why go less when Pepsi's when we're the best? But no, in front of a little bank in Tiberias, I can show you a gun that goes back to the days of Napoleon. And when you look at that, that is 50% of the artillery that Israel had in their war of liberation. 50% of it. One of the main pieces of artillery they had was the Davidka, the little David that wouldn't shoot anything but make a loud noise. He used to scare the living daylights out of the Arabs when they put them in the shoot that thing. And that's that was, they moved it from place to place and scared the living daylights out of them. But anyway, they decided that Israel would die. Some sociologists came. There were Jews then there from 62 different countries in the world. And it's always easy to come in as an expert from the outside. Look over the situation. The next verse, just a little spurt away from home. And they came in, looked over the situation, and said, okay, you've got these Jews now from 62 countries in the world. How in the world are you ever going to blend them into one? Here comes a Jew from Yemen. No Jew in Yemen was ever allowed to ride on a camel because if you're looking down on an Arab. He couldn't be outdoors if it were raining because if the rain fell on him and then on the soil, it would defile the soil. What are you going to do with a Jew that comes from Yemen? Another one comes from Morocco, where there were 300,000 Jews. One comes from Johannesburg with a high standard of living. Some from Canada, the United States, Germany, with all the affluence. You put all these people together, these sociologists said, it'll take you 100 years. It'll take you three generations to ever blend them into one. Last year, one of those same sociologists came back. His opening words were these, I am happy to eat my words. It hasn't taken you 100 years. You've done it in half a generation, with this exception. Instead of Jews being there now from 62 countries in the world, they're in Israel now from 105 countries in the world. And as Moshe Dayan said, we don't have a melting pot over here. We have a pressure cooker. This is just part of the sociological miracle. We're voting now in Florida, in the United States, about what age, you know, they can go in and buy a bottle of beer. Israel doesn't have any laws like that. As I say, I've been there 46 times. It's just the nature of my work, part of it. I have seen two drunk people in Israel in 46 visits. One was a United Nations soldier who was riding in his Jeep and slammed into our bus, and he sobered up awfully fast. The other one was an old Jew from Johannesburg. And he thought winter was coming on early, so he's pouring in the antifreeze. I mean, he really pouring it in. But they're the only two that I've ever seen. The sociological miracle, for instance, across the Jordan River, I was telling a couple of the young ladies today, across the Jordan River, in Jordan, in the kingdom of Jordan, and the king was saying, there are 70,000 that we know of among the Bedouin who have active tuberculosis. They get it from the breath of the camel. The camel sleeps in the tent with them. They have 70,000 have tuberculosis. There are less than 100 beds for TB patients in all of Jordan. We're helping two girls build a hospital over there. It's one of the most thrilling things I've ever been involved in. Israel, in the last 20 years, has done away with tuberculosis. They've taken these Bedouin out of the tents, put them through the Hebrew University, the medical school at the Hadassah Hospital, and for the very first time in history, Bedouin have become medical doctors. I went down the Sinai, what they call the Sinai. I was going down, spent 4 days down the Suez Canal and up Mount Sinai and so forth, and I couldn't believe my eyes. Way in the middle of the Sinai, here was a clinic for the Bedouin that never heard of a clinic, a dental clinic, as well as a medical clinic, and women were coming to doctors for their babies and all. And also the spilling out of Israel sociologically, especially in Africa. They say, we don't have any money, but we do have know-how. Senegal, they are the agricultural experts. First time I went to Liberia, no decent hotels, poor roads. Israel's been there. Ghana, they put a fishing industry in Ghana. Then taught them how to run it, pulled out. They built the government buildings in the Ivory Coast. They dried up the malarial swamps in Nigeria. They have 21 paratrooper experts in the Congo. They have put a pharmaceutical house, a plywood factory in the Congo. If you've been reading the paper right recently, of course, it's easy to forget. Now Uganda's asking them, said they're going to close their embassy. But I was there in April, and I talked for an hour with the Israeli ambassador, and he said that was last year, 1971. They reaped 400 acres of Israeli-type Jaffa oranges in Uganda. So when the crops were finished in Israel, they started shipping from Uganda. This year, 500 acres more, training their army and the Air Force and all the rest of it. And in Kenya, the tremendous power that they've had. And in Ethiopia, all the way through Africa, silently, quietly, doing a job to help these new developing nations. Well, I have to stay there a while, and I'm not like the preacher. They've had a lot of notes. And a little boy watching him from the balcony turned the pages. And yet the last page went on 3 or 4 minutes. And then the preacher looked up and said, well, I could go on for hours on this subject. And the little boy yelled out and said, oh, pipe down, you're out of stuff and you know it. I'm not out of stuff. I'd like to talk a little while longer. So there is the language miracle. There's the sociological miracle of Israel. To be able to blend them in from all of these countries in the world into one people. Then there's also the industrial and the agricultural miracle of Israel. When they were reborn, they said, okay, you want a country? And they only had 8,000 square miles there. You want a country? If you're going to have a country, one thing you have to have is groceries. You've got to have eaten food. Have you ever been over that part of the world? There are a good section of Israel. There are at least 50 rocks for every dirt. That's a factor. Some section, if a rabbit were going to take a walk for a mile, he'd have to pack a lunch before he left home because he wouldn't find enough to keep him alive. I asked, the first time I went, I asked an Arab. He was driving me to the hotel. I said, where in the world is rocks? He said, don't you know where they came from? I said, tell me. He said, God gave all the rocks of the whole world, put them all in a big bag, and tell them to distribute evenly around the world. He got this far and the bag broke. They dumped them all in. They're going to have food. Do you know, in less than 25 years, in the day in which you and I live right now, there are only 6 countries in the world that produce enough food for the population. The United States, Canada, the Argentine, Australia, New Zealand, Israel. They export $170 million worth of stuff to the United States. 10 years ago, they didn't even grow avocados. Last year, they produced $2 million. Last year, $2.5 million worth of strawberries. The flour market for Europe is controlled by Israel. They have a computer system, so when they need flours here, they're put on the plane in the morning, and they're in the markets in Europe in the afternoon, or late that morning. Of course, the biggest money bringer in her, you say, that's not good grammar. We're not saved by grammar, we're saved by grace. Tourism is number one. Diamonds are number two. Israel has the finest diamond cutting and polishing in the world. They lead the world today, diamond cutting and polishing. They export nearly $1 million worth of cut and polished diamonds every day. Cotton is next. Citrus is next. They just surpassed, this year, surpassed citrus with their cotton. All of the world. I say, they are now one of the 6 countries in the world that produce enough food for their population. A miracle. You go to this tremendous 112 square mile Jezreel Valley. You know of it as Armageddon. It's Drelon Megiddo. 3 valleys in one. Isaiah calls it the Fat Valleys. We have some from Britain here. You call him Isaiah. But if you wait till you get to heaven, you'll find his name is Isaiah. But Isaiah called this big valley the Fat Valleys. When the first pioneers came to Israel, the Jewish pioneers, they found this big valley filled with malaria and yellow fever. It was just nothing but a big swamp because of a biblical stream that was blocked by the sands of the Mediterranean. So they knew that this thing could be unblocked. They paid £1.5 million for it with Jewish National Fund money. They were severely chided for wasting all that money. Remember, you hear all the stories that here these newcomers come in and they steal all this land from unsuspecting people, from these Arabs. I want to say this categorically. Of course, there's always injustice in all war. But there's some of that property that these Jews have paid for time and time and time and time over and over again. In fact, they've paid for it that's in Jordan today. There, it's the paid for it. But anyway, paid £500,000. They had no doctors, few nurses, very little medicine. They had big fires at night, keep away the mosquitoes. They drained that swamp so that it became the breadbasket of Israel with 9 crops a year. I wish you could have been with us the other day. You've never seen anything as lush and as beautiful in your days as the Valley of Jezreel is right now. Of course, it'll be different color when I go back in well, a little bit later. The wheat then will be about ready in the latter part of the summer. The Sea of Galilee. And I don't think you can accuse the old rabbis of being over-enthusiastic about Galilee. The rabbis used to say, after God made the seven seas, he created the Sea of Galilee for his own delight. It is 682 feet below sea level, averages 150 feet in depth. There's enough water in Galilee. If no water flowed into the Jordan, none flowed out, there's enough there to supply the needs of New York City for a whole year. Israel has put a 9-foot pipe, that's just about as high as this building, this room. I'm 6 feet, 6 feet 2. A 9-foot pipe into the Sea of Galilee. Water weighs 62 pounds a cubic foot. Can you imagine what kind of pumps it takes to push that water through that pipe? You'll never see the pipe, it's underground. Joining with the other water carrier, flows 165 miles to the south to Beersheba, spills out in the desert, and John Steinbeck, before he died a couple of years ago, who incidentally was not a Jew, John Steinbeck looked at the Negev, the desert, and said, if they can have peace in 10 years' time, the Negev will be the breadbasket of Europe. They're drilling also for oil, of course. They're drilling now this way. If they don't find oil drilling this way, they're going to start drilling this way over in the Saudi Arabia. The Dead Sea, the richest military prize in the world, 27% solid. There is no way to put a price tag in the Dead Sea. At the southern end, it's 1,300 feet deep, it's 1,292 feet below sea level, lowest point on Earth. At the southern end, it's very shallow, so they put a dike right across. They know that green water will evaporate faster than blue. So it takes 6 months for the sun to evaporate that water. They put their equipment in, get the phosphates and bromine. We produce phosphates in Florida. We buy our phosphates from Israel because they're better phosphates. They can scoop it out, send the phosphates and bromides and minerals down to Eilat, so they can take it down to East Africa and around Asia. They also have a modern highway going over to Ashdod, the Philistine city Ashdod. And when that seaport is finished, completely finished, because they're using it now, it'll be the largest seaport in the Mediterranean, where they can send all of this stuff to Europe and the United States and the whole business. Then, after the 6 months and they've scooped out the minerals, they open up the sluice, so let more Arab water flow in, close it up, and they've already sold 8 years' supply. There's not only the agricultural industrial miracle, but there is also the military miracle. And I think, really, I agree with you that anybody who thinks by the inch and speaks by the yard ought to be dealt with by the foot. So I'll let you out so we can get a cup of Ovaltine and go to bed. There's a military miracle. And people are getting tired, sick and tired of hearing about war and all. And Israel, certainly. What they want is peace. But Israel's military posture has ever and always been the same. Always been the same. They have always been outnumbered by their enemies. Their strategy is always the same. And if you'll promise me that you will not tell anybody, I'll give you their military strategy. Will you promise? Their strategy is this. Hit first. They always hit first. Hit hard. Attack, attack, attack. And discuss it later. They know nothing about a defensive war. There would have been nothing like a Vietnam situation. Moshe Dayan had the solution to the Vietnam thing a few years ago. But they wouldn't listen to him. They were outnumbering the days of Abraham. I talked to a friend of mine who was in Dayan's staff and said, David, you guys did pretty well in that six-day war, but not quite as well as the first Hebrew. Abraham had 318 men in his army. He chased five kings all the way to Damascus and recovered everything. That's a pretty good average. When old Joshua went against Jericho, he was outnumbered. I was thinking the other day, can you imagine what would have happened had there been a United Nations? In the days that Joshua went against Jericho, they would have given him a fit. Have to pull back, give it up. He didn't know anything about it. And that was Joshua's minor victory. Jericho was nothing in comparison to his victory at Hazor in the Valley of Hula. Always outnumbered, always the same. Outnumbered in the days of Gideon. I was at Gideon Spring the other day. When you go to Israel, don't let anybody shortchange you out of that one. I don't know what tour you're going on. To my knowledge, we're the only Gentile group that ever goes there. But I wouldn't miss that. It's still there. And it's so terrific. I love to stand there and read the scriptures of the people, and everything fits geographically, the whole thing, the hill of Moray, the valley, everything is the same. Exactly the same as was in Gideon. 300 men, outnumbered in the days of Gideon, outnumbered in the days of David. David didn't have one Jew in his army. He had 37 mercenaries. But I mean, they were men. He said they had faces like lions. They had feet like hyenas' feet. And you go down that area by En Gedi, and you can understand why they had to have. And I can see old Saul now, and he was asleep in that cave. And one of them said to David, said, listen, I'll take that spear and I'll get in I won't hit him twice. What a man David must have been. He said, no, wouldn't let him touch him. Outnumbered in the days of David, outnumbered in the days of David Ben-Gurion, 1956 in the Sinai campaign. He's rising now. Mr. Dulles were nice men, but they sure played the fool in that one. I'll tell you that. But anyway, there wouldn't have been a 67 crisis. There would be a crisis today had it not been for Eisenhower and Dulles in 56. It just would not have been. But Khrushchev sent word. Said, if you don't pull back from the Suez, I'm going to send my mercenaries. This is Russia. Ben-Gurion said, send your mercenaries, we'll take care of them too. You know why he said that? He knew he was tied up and hungry at that time. Outnumbered in our day in which we live. I could go on and tell you something about the Six-Day War. Of course, you know that. That's always better to quit when you're winning. You know the reason it was 6 days. No, they had all their equipment rented from Hertz for a week. And they had and they asked General Rabin, who's now the ambassador in Washington, said, how in the world did you get to the Suez so fast? He said, it was no problem. He said, I happen to be commander-in-chief, and I simply said, charge, and being Jews, they all overcharged. Actually, I have a friend, his name is Jack Levy. Jack's wife is cousin Abba Iba. Jack speaks 11 languages. His first language was Greek, because he had a Greek nurse. He's a baby born in Egypt. Speaks Arabic perfectly, Egyptian accent. And I said, Jack, what were you doing in the 6 days? Through his head. He didn't want to talk. I said, come on, Jack, what were you doing? He said, Roy, I knew we had good intelligence, but I didn't realize how good it was. He said, we had the name of every Egyptian pilot. We knew his rank. We knew his wife's name, the children's name. We knew the villages where they came from. We had the whole business. And he said, they took me to a radio station. We had their wavelength. And he said, I just sat there at a microphone, and I read what they gave me in a perfect Egyptian accent with Arabic. Captain Suleiman, this is Colonel Fossey. Things are not going as we had expected. Your village and named the village is being attacked. We feel your wife and named her. Need you more than we do. Land your MiG at a certain airport. We'll be in touch with you. I said, how many did you talk down, Jack? He said, I'm not sure. It's either 21 or 22. And as soon as they landed, they either shot them as they were coming down, or they got them after they landed. And that there was when the great miracle, the taking of Golan, the hills of Syria,